In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the history of the blues and about one blues performer specifically. His name is Robert Johnson, a man who has become, at least in this time, a certified blues legend. He was embraced by the rock superstars of the 1960s, particularly a lot of the British, white British musicians. Today he enjoys a level of fame, though, that he never enjoyed during his lifetime. In fact, our guest for this part of Focus writes about it like this. He died virtually unknown in a rural backwater without making any appreciable dent on the blues world of his day. How is it that this brilliant but obscure musician came to be hailed long after his death as the most important artist in early blues and the founding father of rock and roll? That is the question we'll try to explore this morning with our guest Elijah Wald. He is a writer and also musician. His previous books, including the award-winning biography of bluesman Josh White, he's also written a book titled Narco Corrido. It's an exploration of the Mexican pop ballads dealing with drugs and politics, and his new book is titled Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues. Amistad is the publisher on this book. It's a division of HarperCollins. It's out in bookstores now, and questions are certainly welcome here on this program if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions or comments, you can give us a call. Mr. Wald, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Well, let me start out by proposing this question that you indeed deal with right up front in the book, and that is, given the fact that you're writing here a history of the blues, in a sense, and given the fact that Robert Johnson was not that well-known or that popular in his own time, why build an entire book about the blues around him?
There really are two reasons. One of them is simply that he is already where most people come to the blues. I think that there are probably a lot of people, I know there are a lot of people, and probably a lot of people listening to this, who the only record they own of any blues music from before World War II is the Robert Johnson complete recordings. Mm. And since people are already starting at that point, it seems like a logical way to start a book to sort of take them in deeper. But the other reason is, I think he's an ideal person through whom to see the blues, because he arrived fairly late on the scene in the first blues boom, and his work takes in all that had come before it. So by listening to his records, you really get an introduction to that whole world. And then looking at how differently his reputation has been seen by white fans long after that first blues boom, it really gives you the contrast between the two audiences, between the black audience that supported this music in its heyday and the white audience that now is its main supporter.
Mm. Well, I think it's really interesting to look at this music and to play and to try, as you do in the book, to try to place it in its context and look at it from that perspective and try to think about how people in Robert Johnson's time thought about it, and then set that alongside how people today are thinking about it when it's a music that it tends to be kind of an esoteric corner of the musical world that has a lot of very dedicated followers, but not very many dedicated followers who look at it as kind of a, not as a living music, but almost as a museum piece.
Well, there are quite a few people who look at it as a living music, and in fact, some of whom are probably going to be pretty irritated with me for saying that its great days are past. But, blues probably has a larger audience now than ever in history, just in terms of having people all around the world who are listening to it. But at the same time, it has a very small audience left among the people who originally supported it, who were sort of the mass black pop audience that now would be listening to, you know, rap and neo-soul.
Mm. Well, I know, you know, maybe I now begun to regret having said what I just said. I guess I do want to say that, yes, there are a lot of people who do believe it's a living music. Well, you play it, so obviously you believe that it's a living music.
Well, I mean, I believe it's still a great music. It's not a living music the way it was in the 30s. Mm. I mean, it's getting to be more like jazz or like classical, a music that sort of is played, but, you know, there's a lot of... We don't have any Duke Ellingtons or Beethovens around anymore, and I would say we also don't have any Robert Johnsons, mm. but there still is enough great music there that it's still very much worth going out and listening to those people who are trying to keep it alive.
Well, let's talk... ask you to talk some about Robert Johnson, and interestingly enough, I guess there is not a whole lot known about Robert Johnson.
Well, there's... No, he is something of a mystery, though I would have to add that because so many people have investigated him, we now actually know more about him than we know about almost any of the major stars of his time. He was born almost certainly in 1911, very poor to illegitimate, in south of the Mississippi Delta, and then grew up most of his life in the Mississippi Delta, way out in the country. But luckily enough, right near a place where a great singer and slide guitarist named Son House was playing every weekend. And he seems to have really been inspired by Son House to start playing music. And went on then to study all the latest records that were coming in from Chicago and St. Louis, which was really, for his generation, he was born, as I say, in 1911, which makes him the generation that we think of as the electric players, people like Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters. But they didn't get to record till later. He did. And he was thinking in that big city way and created this blend of sort of the Delta and the big city sound. But then just as it was really coming together and he had just made these first series of recordings, he was killed, as the story is, poisoned by a jealous husband, and I see no reason not to believe it, and died at age 27.
Well, before we get too much further, I think we better play a little music here. There are a lot of people, I'm sure, listening to us, maybe won't have heard Robert Johnson. We've pulled a few cuts, a few of those that are fairly well known, and we told you which few we had. What would you, to start out, what do you think you'd like to have us play, or we'd like to play?
Well, it's sort of real obvious place to start, a Sweet Home Chicago, because people are so familiar with other versions of it.
All right. Well, this is from the Robert Johnson, the complete recordings. We're getting it queued up. We're getting ready to go here. Okay, this is Sweet Home Chicago.
Chicago. I'm fixing to his eight. gonna do it again, but I'm crying, hey. Baby, don't you want to go? Pretty land of California, to my sweet home, Chicago. I'm going to California, from 30 miles far away. Somebody will tell me that you need my help someday, son. Hey, hey, baby, don't you want to go? Take a land of California to my sweet old Chicago.
All right, that is Robert Johnson, Sweet Home Chicago. What year was that recording?
1936.
So I guess, you talked about at the beginning of the program that there may be some people that in their record collections or CD collections, they have only one blues recording, and this is it's this disc. It's the complete Robert Johnson. So that, and having heard that and hearing that and saying, oh, yes, that's blues. I know that. I know it when I hear it. is that blues?
Well, it sure is an example of blues. I put together a CD that actually goes with the book called Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson. And what you find there is that song we just heard is simply his reworking of a hit for a guy named Kokomo Arnold, who was in fact a big star from Chicago, but who sang at Sweet Home Kokomo, which was sort of, he bet the wrong horse. Kokomo, Indiana did not become the home of the blues. And so we all sing Robert Johnson's version. But yeah, that was very much the sort of mainstream hit blues style for the mid-30s. And the theme was a theme very much appealing to people in the areas of the South. I mean, I called the book Escaping the Delta because I wanted us to remember that we all have this idea that you get into the Mississippi Delta in order to get the real blues feel. But, of course, these guys were playing it in order to get out of the Mississippi Delta.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Elijah Wald. He is a musician and a writer. He's author of the book Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues. It's published by Amistad, which is a division of HarperCollins. And if you have questions, comments, of course, you can pick up the telephone and call us 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, one of the things that I think you really tried to do in the book, as I said, is that establish some sort of context for this music. And in fact, the CD that you've talked about, I think their idea is there to say, okay, maybe you're interested in Robert Johnson or blues, or you've heard some of his music. This is the music that he would have heard.
Exactly.
That might have influenced him, and he might have taken things from individual performers. So that, and I think what you're trying to suggest to people is if you've heard Robert Johnson and you think that is the blues, you would say that is, yes, that is the blues, but that's not all there was to this music. And then in fact, if you look at what people were performing and listening to at the time, they were performing all kinds of music.
That's right.
That reflected what their audience, what they and their audiences were interested in. And it wasn't only this kind of, it wasn't only that.
Yeah, no, I think it's very important to remember that this was not folk music in the 1920s and 30s. Blues was a hot new pop style. And in most parts of the South, it was coming in on record. It wasn't what the old people played already on their front porches. And people like Robert Johnson, they were professional musicians. We now think of them as bluesmen, but that's really sort of an accident because that's what the recording companies happened to want from black guitar players in Mississippi. A guy like Robert Johnson, he was famous for the fact that he could play anything, that he would just be sitting there having dinner with you and listening to the radio in the back of his mind and then would go out in the street and play all the songs that had been on the radio. He could play the latest Bing Crosby hits, Gene Autry, he could yodel like Jimmy Rogers, but we don't have any of that on record. All we have is the blues, so we think of him that way. But, I keep thinking about how much of his blues style may have been affected by the fact that he could also sing Bing Crosby.
Hmm. Well, can you, when you hear him, do you hear that?
Yes, but I'm not sure what I'm hearing it firsthand. Leroy Carr was the most influential male blues singer of this period. A huge, huge star, and people like Ray Charles and Sam Cooke we're still singing Leroy Carr 30 years later. And Carr very much was the Bing Crosby of the blues world. He was the person who took advantage of that new intimacy that came with microphones and recording. Because before that, of course, you know, you had to sing loud enough to be heard over a band or to be heard in a room full of dancers. And suddenly there was this new world where people could bring records right into their living rooms and listen quietly. And if you were performing live, you could have a microphone, and so you could have this new intimacy. And we absolutely hear that on Robert Johnson's recordings. I mean, something like Come On In My Kitchen, you couldn't hear some of that more than a few feet away from him. He's almost whispering. And you couldn't possibly have done anything like that in a blues scene in the Delta even 5 years earlier.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. One of the things you talk about is what performers like Johnson and others in his time would have aspired to. What kind of life? What kind of lifestyle? And it wasn't sitting on a front porch somewhere, picking a guitar for anybody who might happen to stroll by. He and other people were interested in being stars to the extent that one could be a star in that time. They wanted to be popular entertainers. They wanted people to buy their records. They wanted people to come hear them play. They wanted to make money. They wanted to be popular, just like I suppose most performers do.
Yeah, no, it was interesting to me, actually, because I was aware that this was pop music, but until I was working on this book, I had never actually gone back and gone through the Chicago Defender, which was the main black newspaper for that period, and just looked at all the record advertising. And what you find is people like Duke Ellington, Jelly Roll Morton, you know, what we think of as the big jazz stars, were very, very minor figures compared to Bessie Smith, Ida Cox, Ma Rainey, the great blues queens, and then Blind Lemon Jefferson, Lonnie Johnson. The men start to come in toward the end of the 20s. And really, blues was the mainstream black popular music. And particularly when you listen to Robert Johnson, virtually all of his recordings, with the exception of this tiny little bunch he did at the end of his first session, are reworkings of hits from the previous 2 years coming out of Chicago and St. Louis. He really was going for the hit sound of that moment.
He was covering. He was a cover artist.
He wasn't covering, because he tended to write his own variations.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the sense that Christina Aguilera doesn't cover Britney Spears, but it's pretty damn similar. And in the same way, I mean, Robert Johnson was not trying to sound like Son House.
Hmm.
He was trying to sound like Petey Wheatstraw, Kokomo Arnold, Leroy Carr. These are not names a lot of your listeners probably know. But, I mean, when people talk about, you know, there's this myth about Robert Johnson and the devil. Well, one place that could well come from is that the singer he probably most imitated was a guy named Petey Wheatstraw, who was a big star from St. Louis, a piano player. And all of Wheatstraw's records were billed as Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law.
Hmm.
You know, that was a very popular, you know, it was appealing, it was exciting, it was fun.
Well, this you referred to this story that maybe if people have heard nothing else about Robert Johnson, the story was that he sold his soul to the devil in exchange for his ability to play. And that's something that's a story, I guess, that people really like. Where did that do we know where that got started? And did he, in fact, start that? And was that something that he would have, not in a serious way, but the kind of thing he would have said with a chuckle?
Well, he certainly sang a couple of songs that mention the devil. Yeah, exactly what you just said. My feeling is, you know, the one time I have actually heard or seen an interview with someone who knew him, it's a guy named Willie Coffey, who grew up with him and continued to know him through his life. And there's a wonderful film in which a blues expert asks Willie Coffey, "So did he ever tell you that he sold his soul to the devil?" And Coffey goes, "Oh, sure, he was always kidding around like that. We never took it seriously." I think really people started taking that seriously when the white fans got into it, and they were looking for this sort of haunted, mysterious figure. And then, of course, you know, most of us today came to blues and came to Robert Johnson through the Rolling Stones. And our image of Robert Johnson is really as sort of this father, grandfather of Keith Richards, you know, that dangerous thing, and the Rolling Stones, you know, with their Satanic Majesty's Request and Sympathy for the Devil. Their audience really was looking for that, for exactly what Robert Johnson is.
Well, why don't we play something else?
Sure.
What do you think?
Might as well play Crossroads.
That's kind of what I was thinking about, too. Yeah. Well, let's do that. Again, this is from Robert Johnson, The Complete Recordings. This is Crossroad Blues. Crossroad Blues by Robert Johnson, going out to all those people who thought Jack Bruce and Eric Clapton wrote that. or maybe folks do know that version from the from Cream in the 1960s. Talk about Johnson and his, what he brought to the music. What is very distinctive about him?
Well, there are a couple of things. I think the main thing is he is the perfect fusion of the Delta sound and the more sort of urban hip sound of that time. I mean, the older Delta players, who were people like Son House, Charlie Patton, were playing a much sort of rougher, grittier sound. And Robert Johnson had started off with that, and he has still kept a lot of that. But he also, being a lot younger, is listening to the hit guys coming out of Chicago. And he has that smoothness, and his songs are also put together very carefully. A lot of the older guys, they would just sing a lot of different verses, but something like Crossroads, he very clearly has, you know, started in one place, and he's going forward, and the song builds. It's very well, it's a well-constructed piece of pop music, whereas, you know, the old blues guys, they'd often play for 15 or 20 minutes with a single song, and they just weren't used to putting together a perfect three-minute song. So there's that. I think the other thing he brought to it, which in a lot of ways has contributed to making him the legend he is because of that fusion, he also is the perfect way in for people, you know, like me, a white guy born in Boston, who maybe if I had just heard Charlie Patton, it would have been too rough or too weird for me. But Robert Johnson has smoothed it out enough that he lets us in.
Was there a wide audience for this music in its time, or was it truly pretty much just black Americans listened to it?
There was a wide audience, but it was very small. I mean, there were always white people who were buying blues records, and in some strange places. I was talking to a man who grew up in Oxford, England, and he said that one of his parents' friends used to get the whole Paramount Race catalog. Race was the term then for black music. Used to get the whole Paramount Race catalog sent to him in Oxford. But there were very few people like that. Down in the South in the U.S., there were more. I mean, all these guys like Robert Johnson would play for white picnics as well as playing for black gigs. But they probably would have played a lot less blues when they were doing those.
It's interesting, not very long ago I talked with a fellow who's just recently written a biography of Bessie Smith, which talks about the fact that she did perform for a lot of mixed-race audiences, but that primarily was in the South, which kind of surprised me.
No, I mean, you know, to put it in its simplest terms, American racism never prohibited black people from dancing or singing for white people. Hmm. They just didn't want them, you know, being on an equal basis. And Bessie Smith, they used to have these things called midnight rambles in the black theaters, say in Memphis. There would be a black theater, and Bessie Smith would play there, and then there'd be a special midnight show, which would be for an all-white audience, and which would often be broadcast on the radio. And so, you know, it's not that it wasn't segregated, but there was also in the Soul Revolution, that was true, that, you know, people like Otis Redding, instantly there was a white audience for those guys.
I want to have you talk about how it is that some white figures, first of all, we had people like John Hammond, who was a very famous record producer, and Alan Lomax, who was a famous ethnomusicologist who went and collected some of this music, and then perhaps later a white guitarist primarily, and a lot of these guys were British. There were people like Eric Clapton and others at the time who became interested in this music. How that ended up shaping what a lot of people think of as blues, and as you write about in this book, in the process, selecting somebody like Johnson, who was not all that big a figure of his time, selecting somebody like him and elevating him to this very high status, while at the same time perhaps dismissing other performers who were at in their time big stars. I mean, how did all of this happen?
Well, obviously that's a big question, and I spend several chapters on it. But I guess the short way of looking at it is the first people who came to it, you mentioned John Hammond and Alan Lomax. And for John Hammond, he was a jazz fan, and what he was listening for in blues was the roots of jazz. Basically, for him, blues was where Louis Armstrong and Count Basie came from. And so he was looking not for someone who was up in Chicago being a contemporary star. He was looking for the roots. And Alan Lomax was a folklorist, and he was looking for the black equivalent of, say, the Appalachian British ballads. So he again was looking for the roots. And so when they presented blues, they weren't presenting the most popular artists. They were trying to present people who were out there and could be seen as, you know, the farthest back, the deepest. Then the next generation, when you get into the people like Eric Clapton, the Rolling Stones, they basically, you know, they'd grown up in England, and then they had heard Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry, and it had just changed their lives. And as they were getting the Chuck Berry records, they began getting a few records of Muddy Waters, of Howling Wolf, and that was the next stage. That was rawer, it was wilder, and for them it was even more exciting. And when they heard Robert Johnson, which John Hammond, who we mentioned earlier, led to this LP coming out, which was the first LP of early blues to ever come out on a major label, except for Bessie Smith. And they heard that LP, and it was the roots of Muddy Waters and Howling Wolf. And I mean, you know, Robert Johnson really does sound absolutely like the Roots of Muddy Waters, but it's this odd coincidence that they got into Chicago and the Chicagoans had come from Mississippi. If what they had got into was T-Bone Walker and the L.A. sound, and, I mean, the L.A. electric guitarists were much, much more popular in Muddy Waters' day than Muddy Waters. I mean, people like T-Bone Walker and Lowell Fulson and Ray Charles were much bigger stars. And those guys all came from Oklahoma and Texas. So if the Rolling Stones had got into them, they would have been down in Dallas, not looking down in Clarksdale, Mississippi.
Hmm. In one of the reviews of the book, there was a wonderful story that the reviewer tells. This is a review by Susan Larson, and it appeared in the Times Picayune of New Orleans. And she tells this wonderful story that she was told by Dave Van Ronk.
Now, it's actually from the book.
Oh, it's actually from the book. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Okay.
It's my story, but it's a great story.
Okay. Well, it's your story. The way that the review is written up, it makes it sound like it's her story. Okay. Well, the story goes that it's your story. It comes from the book. That Van Ronk was at a blues festival in New England, and he came a little late, and he wasn't sure who else was on the bill, and he did his show, and he ended with Hoochie Coochie Man. And a really strong, tough, aggressive, kind of wild man performance. And so he finishes and everybody applauds and he comes off stage and comes face to face with Muddy Waters, that was his song. And Muddy Waters had been watching Van Ronk play. And the story is that Muddy kind of puts his arm around Dave and says, "That was very good, son." But then he said, "But you know, that's supposed to be a funny song." I love that story because I think it speaks volumes of how different people come to the music and what it is they think it's about, and also maybe a big difference between the way often white audiences approach this music and black audiences approach the music.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, one of the key moments way before I was working on this book, but that got me thinking about it, was reading an interview with John Hammond Jr., the son of the record producer, who is a very, very good blues singer in his own right, and who, really knows his Robert Johnson. When the Complete Recordings came out, some magazine was interviewing him about it, and he said, but what people miss is the humor in this. And then he quoted the line, "Bury my body down at the highway side so my old restless spirit can catch a greyhound bus and ride." He said, that's a funny line. And, we don't think about it because we think of a greyhound bus as sort of being how poor people travel. But a greyhound bus in 1936 was a brand new thing in the Mississippi Delta. And the idea of this ghost down by the highway side wanting to catch a greyhound bus, it's like talking about, bury me down by Kennedy Field so that my restless spirit can catch the Concorde to Paris. I mean, it's hip and it's funny.
Yeah. We have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, I guess I feel like we should play some more music. We just have a couple of other cuts. And I don't know, again, if you'd like to... Apparently Love in Vain, the audio quality is not real great, so I guess maybe that it leaves us with either Hellhound on My Trail, which is one of those sort of famous Johnson tunes, and the other, I Believe I'll Dust My Broom. I don't know, you want to, either one or the other?
Why don't we go with Hellhound, because we've been playing some lighter things, and that's his deepest, that's a scary one.
Yeah, okay, then we'll do that. This is Robert Johnson. This is from the disc King of the Delta Blues. It's Hellhound on My Trail.
I got to keep moving. I got to keep moving. Blues falling down like hail. Blues falling down like hail. Blues falling down that hill. And the day keeps on running me. It's a hellhound on my trail. Hellhound on my trail. Hellhound on my trail. If the day was Christmas Eve, is the day of Christmas Eve, and tomorrow's Christmas Eve. If the day is Christmas Eve, and tomorrow's Christmas Day, oh, wouldn't we have a time, baby? I would need my little sweet ride just to pass the time away, to pass the time away. You think I'm hot foot bottom around my door, all around my door. You think I'm hot foot bottom around your daddy's door. Every old place I go, every old place I go. I can tell the wind is rising, the leaves trembling on the tree, trembling on the tree. I can tell the wind is rising, leaves trembling on the tree. I need my little sweet woman, and to keep my company, my company.
All right, that's Robert Johnson, Hellhound on My Trail. We're talking this morning with Elijah Wald. He's a writer and also a blues musician. He's written a book about Johnson and about the blues, which is titled Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues. It's published by Amistad, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. Also, if you're interested in listening to music, not only Johnson, but the kinds of music that perhaps would have inspired him, the kind of music that he would have listened to, you might want to look for a CD that is just out that our guest has worked on. It is titled Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson, and Yazoo Records is the label. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Anything I have a caller we'll get on to, but anything in particular you want to say about that cut?
Just quickly, yeah, there's an interesting thing about that, because I've talked about how he was imitating or, you know, building on records by late recent stars, but he wasn't just a pop musician, and that song is based on the work of a man named Skip James, who now is idolized, but who was extremely little known at that time, and who Johnson clearly had great affection for. He covered two of Skip James's records. And so, you know, I don't want to overemphasize him as if he was just trying to be a pop musician.
Let's talk with caller here. We have someone in Bourbonnais on line number one.
Hi.
Hi.
I have several quick questions, if you will.
Sure.
The first is, what does Dust My Broom mean? I've heard Chris Smither use it and Dylan uses it.
Yeah, sure. It basically means I'm just going to get out of here.
Oh.
I'm going to dust my broom. I'm leaving.
Okay. All right, simple as that.
Yeah.
The second thing is, when I heard you referring to the complete records of Robert Johnson, I remembered that I bought that, and then when I got it home and compared it with an older Robert Johnson CD that I had, it wasn't complete at all. There were a couple of songs on my older one that weren't on the newer one.
Nope. All I could say is nope. There is one alternate track that is not on the complete. But other than that, it is complete. I don't know what the songs would be that you're thinking of.
Okay, well, I can't get to it now, so I'll have to recheck it. I heard a story about Robert Johnson that at one point earlier in his career, he went to a juke joint or something and was basically laughed off the stage for his playing.
Oh, yeah.
He went home and woodshedded for hours and hours every day.
Yeah, Sunhouse used to tell that story. Sunhouse and a guy named Willie Brown used to play regularly around where Johnson was growing up, and Johnson would come and play harmonica for them. And he was a good harmonica player, but House said he kept wanting to take their guitars during their breaks, and it was just the most god-awful sound you ever could hear. His quote was, a dog wouldn't want to listen to it. And then Johnson went off, depending on who you talk to, for 6 months or a year and a half, and came back and just completely blew everybody away. And, you know, they often say it happened so quickly, he must have sold his soul to the devil. But anybody who spent their lives in music knows that a 15 or 16-year-old who has talent, who runs off for a year, can just come back and, you know, anything is possible.
Yeah, well, that keeps us all going. I got that story out of R. Crumb's book on the...
Sure.
That's a great book.
Yeah, no, Crumb is one of the devoted 78 record collectors. I mean, he was one of the guys who back in the 60s already was combing the outback looking for these old blues records. And it's interesting, he really knows that side of it. On the other hand, his job is to be a cartoonist. So, you know, you get a lot more devils and a lot more down and dirty.
Yeah.
Then I think is in fact an accurate portrayal. I mean, one of the things I've got in my book is this poll that this guy took out in the Delta plantations in 1940, asking people, who's your favorite musician? What's your favorite record? And what you learn is that the people out there in the juke joints in the wild and mysterious Delta were listening to Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman, and, you know, they were into blues. It was the local sound. They liked it. But they by no means were a bunch of people who didn't know nothing but that stuff. They also were very conscious. You know, they knew who Bing Crosby was. They just also appreciated Charlie Patton.
The magic of radio.
Exactly. And of records. I mean, there were jukeboxes by Robert Johnson's day. Everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. What does juke mean?
It's another word for dancing, as far as I know, to go out juking. But... You know, I'm not 100% on that one. Jukebox, juke joint, I believe it's just dancing.
Okay. Have you seen that calendar that's out this year of all the blues labels?
Oh, sure. And that's an interesting thing. That's a calendar put out by another record collector, a man named John Tefteller, who's put together a lot of the Paramount Records advertisements from the Chicago Defender. And he included a CD that includes a couple of very odd and interesting things. He found this test pressing by Tommy Johnson. And Tommy Johnson is one of the greatest of the old Delta players, and in fact is the one who we actually have the story from about meeting the devil at the crossroads. It was Tommy Johnson, not Robert Johnson, who told that story. And all that ever existed of Tommy Johnson were these deep Delta blues cuts, and now with that calendar is this CD of this test pressing he did before he made his first recording for Paramount, and he is singing basically a Jimmy Rogers-type cowboy song and yodeling. And I think it's a really good example of how little we really know about these guys because the fashion of the time meant that all we have is their blues work. And who knows? I mean, Muddy Waters, when Alan Lomax first discovered him in 1941-42 and recorded him, all he recorded of Muddy was blues, but he also took a repertoire list. Muddy played 7 Gene Autry songs. He played Chattanooga Choo Choo. He played Red Sails in the Sunset.
One of the questions I think it's interesting, I'm sure you've thought about this, is what we have now, because Johnson died as early as he did and his career never went any further, he and his music gets frozen in time. The interesting question is, if he would have lived and continued to perform, what sort of music he would have been playing, and whether he would have been playing the same, the kinds of things that we know, or whether he would have been doing something else?
Well, obviously I can't say with any certainty what he would have been doing. I would say with absolute certainty he would not have kept playing the same stuff, and he would not have ended up sounding like Muddy Waters or Elmore James, which is what most people think, which is basically just an electrified version of that deep Delta sound. Johnson was clearly a hipper musician than they were, and was clearly, by the time he died, already very much moving into, you know, sort of the mainstream of the younger, hipper styles. And my guess is he would have ended up sounding, you know, more in the direction of jump blues, like, you know, T-Bone Walker or Charles Brown, people who were smoother, who had, you know, a lot of jazz sound, sort of, I don't know, almost electric cafe blues, but not that sort of hard barroom sound.
Mm. Because he was a guitarist, that's no doubt part of the reason that the British guitarists latched on to him and his music when when the primary jazz, I mean, the primary blues instrument of the time, of Robert Johnson's time, would have been the piano.
Certainly. I mean, it was, guitar was big then, but it's true. I mean, most of the big stars, even if they played guitar, there was always a piano on the records. And the biggest stars, Leroy Carr, Petey Wheatstraw, Bumblebee Slim, were mostly piano players. And that's right. It's very much the rock world that, and also the folk world, because, of course, the folk singers, you know, Woody Guthrie, it was also guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And the piano players really kind of got written out of blues history, which is just a complete rewriting of the story.
So how was it that you got interested in blues and became a blues guitarist yourself?
You know, I guess it was partly chance. I had an older half-brother, considerably older, who was a blues fan and who left his records with me when I was a kid. And so I heard it. And, I mean, I started off with Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, but when I heard blues, it was just so exciting. And, you know, then I'm a guitar player myself. And it's one of the great virtuoso styles. I mean, there's just something about it. But why blues and not something else? You know, how do any of us know the answer to that one?
We have, oh, maybe about 5 minutes, a little bit less in this part of Focus with Elijah Wald. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, wonder what it is that perhaps in having this very limited view of what the blues are, is, and never sure which way that should go, about this music, what is it that we lose, or what sort of appreciation do we gain by having this broader sort of perspective that says, yeah, Robert Johnson was a great performer, and there's a lot of wonderful things in his music, but that's not the only thing that blues is, and there were all kinds of other sorts of things. It was in kind of going in different directions,
sure,
and with different flavors at the point when it was a big music in and of itself.
Well, I think there are a few things we lose. One of the obvious things is that blues has become a very male music, both in terms of the fans and in terms of who's playing it. And blues was, for its first 15 years, all the stars were women. And even straight through Muddy Waters' age, most of the record buyers, as long as it was black pop music, were women. I mean, this intensely male thing is definitely an addition, you know, of the post-Rolling Stones world. So we've lost that. It was just much broader, and I think a lot of people who think they don't like blues, really what it is they've only heard that one side of blues, and there's plenty else there that they would like. And then, of course, you know, we've lost just the idea that these guys were smart, professional musicians.
Mm-hmm.
We've got this idea that, you know, that Robert Johnson was a magnificent monster. And he wasn't a magnificent monster. He was a very intelligent young musician with a very good idea of what the music world of his day looked like and how he could fit into it.
I think that that's interesting that somehow in the whole blues mythology we have come to elevate amateurism as if somehow polish and drive and the desire to be a big star, whatever that meant at the time, as if there was something wrong with that.
Wrong with that, yes, absolutely. Well, obviously part of that, you know, there are two sides of that. One side of that is the aesthetic that gave us punk rock, and, you know, that just says energy, it counts for more than skill. And part of it, of course, is race and racism, you know, is the idea that what's great about black culture is primitive emotion, whereas what's great about white culture is Shakespeare and Mozart. And, you know, that's just flat out wrong. I mean, frankly, what's great about white culture involves a lot of emotion as well, and what's great about black culture, God knows, involves just as much intelligence and skill as any other culture.
Well, there we'll leave it with, again, the suggestion that if people would like to read more about the blues, you can look for this book we've talked about, Escaping the Delta, Robert Johnson and the Invention of the Blues. It's published by Amistad, which is an imprint of HarperCollins. And then if you're interested in listening to some music, you can go out and look for the CD that we've mentioned too, Back to the Crossroads, The Roots of Robert Johnson from Yazoo Records. And I think that's just out. Our guest, Elijah Wald, he is a writer and a blues musician. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And let me just quick mention, I do also have a website. It's just my name, ElijahWald.com.
All right. Well, again, thanks much. We appreciate it.